May it please the court. Craig Weinberg, registration number 19030, appearing on behalf of Michael Lohman, who is the appellant in this case. Your Honor, I struggled with how to begin this argument, obviously this case involves us all dusting off our old civil procedure textbooks and digging back into international shoe and those types of cases. My review of the law indicates two different but related standards, and it's not clear to me from reading the case law which standard might apply here, but I'll run through each of those because I don't think it matters in the final analysis. The first standard stems from the case Marriage of Seawall, which has somewhat similar facts, involved a Mexican decree and a claim about the validity or invalidity of that particular decree. That court relied upon the restatement third of foreign relations to establish that the principle that there would be no personal jurisdiction unless the defending spouse was domiciled in or a resident of the foreign country and or has consented to the exercise of jurisdiction.
But did your predecessor counsel make that argument to the trial court?
At what point in time? At the hearing?
At any point in time.
Yeah, Your Honor, when we came into the case, we made that argument. We absolutely made that argument. And in fact, I believe my predecessor counsel cited to the Seawall case in his trial brief.
But wasn't his focus whether or not there was service of process as opposed to minimum contacts?
His principal focus was indeed on service. He had raised Hague Convention issues. There is reference in the transcript, however, to a lack of minimum contacts with the United Kingdom. So it was raised at the hearing. It was raised prior to the hearing in the response to the verified petition, and it was raised in post-trial motions by us several times. The judge issued an order saying that it had been raised several times and rejected several times, and in fact was becoming irritated that we continue to raise the same argument. But I think the trial judge missed the boat, because the trial judge's jurisdictional order was premised solely on what he called a concession of service. And there are two ways of obtaining jurisdiction under the traditional standards. One is you serve somebody in the jurisdiction. My civil procedure professor referred to that as the gotcha approach. You serve somebody in the jurisdiction, it didn't happen here. If you don't serve them in the jurisdiction, then there has to be a minimum contacts analysis. The trial judge never made the second step, assuming that service was all it took.
But did your predecessor counsel tell the judge, you're misperceiving this? There are two components. There's service of process and minimum contacts. Did anything like that ever get said to the trial judge?
Yes.
Before you got involved on post-trial motions?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe I can find the page reference in the transcript, but I believe it was around page 150 to 153, somewhere in there. He did talk about the lack of minimum contacts. Arguably, it's not the clearest transcript.
But it seems like, counsel, he mentioned that phrase, but he didn't offer any analysis about why there were no minimum contacts.
I think that's right.
Is that sufficient to preserve the claim?
I think the claim was clearly raised before the trial court. I don't know to what extent he needed to detail that at the hearing. It was preserved in his response to the petition. It was preserved.
When you say it was preserved by what? By saying personal jurisdiction or by saying something more than that?
He objected, yes. I mean, there wasn't a brief per se on that issue, but the defense of a lack of personal jurisdiction was raised as a defense to the petition.
Right, but on what basis? Because as you've already said, there are multiple bases, or at least two. And if he only challenged personal jurisdiction on one basis, which was lack of service, how does that preserve a claim on the other basis, which is lack of minimum contacts?
I think it's notice pleading insofar as the response saying the court in England lacked personal jurisdiction. I think it's sufficient to put everybody on notice. It was mentioned at the hearing, and it was most definitely raised in post-trial motions, which gave the trial court an opportunity to rule on it. And the trial court ruled on it multiple times.
Did the trial court rule on the post-trial motion?
Yes.
After the minimum contacts issue was specifically raised by you, did the trial court then reject the argument that there was or wasn't minimum contacts?
The trial judge never got to that step in the analysis, but in the denial of the post-trial motion, the trial judge acknowledged that the issue had been raised again and denied it again on the basis that Mr. Lohman had conceded service, so he never made the second step. I don't know if that answers your question, but he was under the gotcha approach, which clearly didn't apply here because the service was not in the United Kingdom.
Mr. Weinberg, let me look at the larger context of this sentence. So let's look at before post-trial when you are involved, and we're looking at what does the trial court have before it. And we have the argument whether there was a question about did he concede having service. And then it looks to me that in this discussion, then the court, and this is page 37 of the transcript, is then saying, okay, then I'd like to know now, but it seems to me if there's no other legal attack on the English proceedings, then we're down to the determination of the merits of whether it was a support order or whether it was property division. And nobody spoke up and said, we have another legal attack, and that's based on international shoe minimum context at that point. And so given that context, I'm a little bit concerned about what you're saying is the court did have the opportunity then to address the minimum contacts issue.
I guess it depends on what point in time you're referring to. Mm-hmm. I agree that the hearing transcript is not perfect. But I think it's enough. There's enough there. If you look at page 150, despite the mm-hmm. passage that you quoted, if you look at page 153, you'll see that prior counsel indicate, but the jurisdiction of the English court is nevertheless flawed by the lack of minimal contacts that Mr. Lohman had.
Right. Well, let me push back on that piece a little bit, because then he goes, that allowed the English court to make anything that effectively would be real estate in Colorado. So in the shoes of the trial court, is the court hearing that as a separate minimal contacts argument beyond personal service? Or is this just the question about you need something more when you're talking about real estate because English courts can't mess around with Colorado real estate?
Again, the transcript is really hard to decipher. Mm-hmm. I wasn't there. None of us were there. Mr. DiCola was there. He'll have a different viewpoint on it. But the timing of when something was raised shouldn't prevent this court from confirming an injustice in the case.
But doesn't the timing matter a lot? Because a trial court doesn't have any obligation to consider new arguments raised in a post-trial motion. So if, in fact, it was made for the first time in a post-trial motion and the court didn't address it, we certainly can't find an abuse of discretion.
But the court did address it, and the court was angry about having to readdress it. And
the court addressed minimum contacts analysis in its post-trial motion?
No, because the court found that it essentially believed it never needed to get to that point because of the concession of service. If the issue had not been raised, and if the issue had not been preserved, and if the issue had been waived, the trial judge would have said, sorry, but I'm not hearing that issue. Instead, the trial court found that the English court had jurisdiction. This court is in the position to review that finding on the basis of what the trial court said, which was there's jurisdiction there because he conceded service. If you, and I think you would have to reverse that conclusion, you can remand it back to the trial court to make findings or have a hearing over minimum contacts, were that even necessary. I don't think it's necessary under the restatement standard in the CWA.
I want to go back to Judge Lichtenstein's question. There was a reference to minimum contacts in the context of affecting title to property. I guess my question is, what does minimum contacts have to do with a foreign jurisdiction having the authority to affect title to real property in Colorado? Isn't that different than minimum contacts?
Again, it's not the most artfully phrased passage, but the point is that it was raised. So it's not clear to me if what he's talking about is real estate or if it's minimum contacts or if it's international shoe. But let me posit this for a second. let's get away. You all seem to be focused on minimum contacts, and I'm glad that you're focused there. But there is the other part of that, which is the CWOL standard and the restatement standard don't require minimum contacts. They look to residence and domicile. And there wasn't any of that. So in fact, the English court found that Mr. Lohman lived in Colorado at the time. So you don't even need the next step in the analysis. That was sort of my second standard that was out there.
So, well, but were those issues raised to the court? In other words, an argument made that because he's not domiciled there, he doesn't live there, that the English court simply had no jurisdiction over him, and a Colorado court, therefore, would not enforce that judgment?
Again, it's a timing question. It was definitely raised post-trial. And to your point, Judge, you know, I think Rule 59 allows parties to ask the judge to reconsider errors of law. This is clearly an error of law. It was clearly raised in post-trial motion, and it and ignoring it allows a foreign wife to reap a substantial windfall in excess of $1 million against a retired school teacher. That is not what this country was founded on, and we do not, I mean, we are happy to recognize foreign judgments, but what if this judgment was issued in Iran or some other country? Would there be an issue about due process? Notice there should be. It shouldn't matter that it was the UK, just because we're friendly with the UK. The protections that the law affords should be applied in this case, even if it's in a post-trial motion. It shouldn't make any difference. My client shouldn't wind up bankrupt over what is in effect a default divorce judgment without notice.
Without notice? He had plenty of notice of the English proceedings. He just chose not to participate.
That's true in part and not true in part. The testimony at the hearing was very clear from Mr. Lohman, and it was his position, that he didn't receive notice of the financial hearing until after the hearing. The trial court found that he had plenty of notice. So
we're bound by that finding, aren't we?
I think you are bound by that finding, although I'm not sure what evidence there is in the record to support that other than the UK judge's statement that, well, he knew about the proceeding. But again, if you go back to the Seawall case, it says knowing about the proceeding is not a substitute for formal service of process. It says that right in the decision. And even if you accept the trial judge's finding in that regard, you'd still have to find proper service of process, which didn't exist here.
You claim, I'm confused, because I thought your argument was that since there were no minimum contacts or the requirements under the restatement, that this is a void judgment. I didn't think you were saying that there hadn't been service of process. Are you saying there was no service of process?
No, I didn't mean to be confusing that way. There was service of process. The service of process was in Colorado. That type of service of process, however, doesn't give a foreign state or country jurisdiction over somebody absent minimum contacts, or in restatement's vernacular, a residency domicile type of analysis. I'd like to reserve my remaining time. Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Anthony J. DeCole. My registration number is 5598. At the beginning of the hearing, well, let me back up. Mr. Lohman's previous counsel had raised every issue in the whole world, and we responded to all of those in our trial hearing. He raised the fact, everything you could think of. So at the beginning of the hearing, we made it clear that there was one issue left. One issue. Was this a support order or was this a property division? That's what Judge O'Hara decided. Period, end of story. Page 7, page 38, page 44, over and over and over again. Judge O'Hara said, that's all you're asking me for to decide? Yes, it is. Because, and this thing later on, like 153, that was about an English court cannot divide property in Colorado. So the whole question was, is this a maintenance order or is this a property order?
But personal jurisdiction has nothing to do with the authority of a Colorado court to divide property, of a foreign court to divide property in Colorado. It's just that subject matter jurisdiction, not personal jurisdiction. Once someone raises personal jurisdiction, I mean, you go back to your first course in law school, isn't it just plainly obvious, or shouldn't it be plainly obvious to everyone that that encompasses the minimum contacts inquiry?
Mr. Servadan agreed that it did not include minimum contacts. What he said was, Judge, all you have to decide is this support or not support. Now, if I'll digress for a second. If we had gotten into minimum contacts, if we had gotten into that, and we never did, it was never raised, never tried, and Mr. Servadan essentially said the judge didn't have to decide it. We would have gotten into that. You would have heard that in the petition, it stated that husband resided in Great Britain. In the petition, it said that Mr. Malwitz, under the Malwitz case, that he had forced her to move to Great Britain. In the petition, it said that he visited Great Britain regularly. In the pleadings, it said that he gave her a credit card to use while she was in Great Britain, that he paid child support to her in Great Britain, that he wrote letters as part of the evidence, that he had written letters to the school directing how he wanted his son taught, that he had all sorts of contacts with Great Britain, and that's in the pleadings. But that was never tried at the district court level because Mr. Servadan said you only have one thing to decide, and that's whether or not this is support. And it's clear in the record.
But Mr. DeCola, regardless of what the parties asked the court to decide, the court actually decided more than that. The court specifically said it was deciding the jurisdictional issue. So regardless of whether it was asked to, it did go there, and it found that there was personal jurisdiction. The English court had personal jurisdiction over the husband. So regardless of whether he was asked to find that or she was asked to find it, the trial court made that finding, so don't we have to review it?
The defendant, Mr. Servadan, and his attorney, agreed there was personal jurisdiction. He said he's been properly served. Because what Judge O'Hara said was, okay, he's been properly served. And then Mr. Servadan goes, well, but he didn't get notice of the financial hearing. And Judge O'Hara said, well, in for a diamond for a dollar. He's been served the petition, he's been served the summons, he has notice of the proceeding. That's the only way it was raised, Judge. And that's the only way it came up. Mr. Servadan tried, initially, it made a hay argument, and he backed off of that. The only question was, had he been personally served with process? And later on, he said, and he didn't get notice of the second hearing.
Mr. DeCola, let me ask you something. If you're responding to a complaint, the lack of personal jurisdiction is an affirmative defense, right?
Yes.
So in your answer to the complaint, if you just say the court is without personal jurisdiction over the defendant, does that raise or preserve the entirety of the defense of personal jurisdiction?
Not when the judge says you persist in that pleading at trial and you say, no, I do not. Not when you say that. Because the record is absolutely clear. It's absolutely clear. I mean, it's over and over and over again. Is that the only question you're asking me to decide? Is yes. I need to talk about a couple of things, okay? The appellant raises the fact that he says everything is not properly exemplified. The statute says all written pleadings and court orders, judgments, decrees, those are properly exemplified. It's like the second document in the pleading. It's all double certified. It's all there. All written pleadings, court orders, judgments, and decrees. With regard to...
Mr. DeCola,
yes.
Before you go there, if we determine that the record does not demonstrate sufficient minimum contacts and that somehow that argument was preserved, what do we do? Do we remand it for further findings? Do we just vacate the judgment? What do we do?
If you find that, okay, then I think you would have to remand it, okay, because it was never taken up by the judge, okay. And I submit there's plenty of stuff in the record that actually constitutes sufficient contacts under any of the cases. But under Malwitz, if you look at the Malwitz case, it talks about forcing wife to go. Forcing wife to go. And that's in the record, okay? That she was forced to go to Great Britain by the husband. And that's at, if I can tell you where it is. That's in her petition. It's at page 77. Where she talks about all the reasons she had to go to Great Britain. He wouldn't have sex with her. He wouldn't talk about finances. It talks about all the reasons. And then if you start going into that analysis, at the attorney for Mrs. Lohman wrote Mr. Lohman a letter and said, we're going to go to court and ask for a lump sum maintenance award. And that letter's in the record. You need to know this. You need to appear. You need to, because we're going to ask for a lump sum maintenance. And if you don't appear, we're going to get a lump sum maintenance award against you. And Great Britain is not Iran. Great Britain is the country that on August 23rd, 1994, Gail Norton wrote a letter to saying we're a reciprocating state for purposes of uniform reciprocal.
But that's not a contact within the meaning of Pinoy or an international shoe. I mean, the fact that someone says, unless you come into the forum, you're going to suffer adverse consequences, that's not a contact.
No, that has to do with fair play. It has to do with the second prong that they talk about in Mollis with regard to fair play. Okay. Number one, we have all the contacts that are in the pleadings. He's lived there. He's written letters there. He said what he wants. And he's given her a credit card to spend money there. He's actually he's given her a credit card. It's in the record to spend money there. So, but the second prong is this fair? And the bottom line is her attorney told him what he was going to do. That's what makes it fair.
Mr. DeCola? Do you agree that by the in the post-trial motion, the husband raised this minimum contacts question? And it's, I guess, do you have an opinion on that point?
I've got it right. Give me just a second, please.
Sure.
The court finds that husband's arguments contained in the present motion have been raised, argued, and addressed prior to the order confirming registration.
But my question was about the motion, not the order. So the husband has said that in the post-trial motion, he definitely raised it much more clearly the minimum contacts issue. And in as you've started to read, in the post-trial order, the court didn't say that's a new argument. The court simply said, this is the same argument you've raised before that I've already rejected. So the court didn't seem to perceive this argument about minimum contacts to be new.
I think what the court perceived was Mr. Surbinin saying, the only thing you have to decide is whether or not this is a support order. It had been discarded by the appellant previously. The appellant did not raise it in any way, shape, or form during the trial at all.
So your opposing counsel was stating that under Rule 59, that a question of law, if there's an error of law, may be raised in that motion, and he's saying that the minimum contacts issue is a question of law, and I'd like you to respond to that argument.
First of all, as I pointed out, there are sufficient minimum contacts in the pleadings to establish minimum contacts, but that was never the issue for this trial. The court asked over and over and over again, about what do you want me to decide? And the court was told by both counsel, we want you to decide whether or not this is support or property division. I mean, it really couldn't be clearer. The judge kept on asking over and over again. And I think what he was doing was saying, is this what you want me to decide, period of the story? And that's what he got. And that's when you asked me, Judge Berger, what happens, okay? If you found something wrong, then it needs to be remanded because it never came up. Maybe there was some mistake by somebody, but not by me, and not by opposing counsel, and not by the judge, because that's what he was told to decide, one issue. And what the English judge did was he said, look it, I'm saying this is a support order. That's what I'm saying. I'm writing you a letter, Judge O'Hara. I'm writing you a letter. Here's what I'm doing. Here's how I decided it. Here's how I laid it out. here's everything I did. Judge O'Hara says he made a decision just like I would make with regard to maintenance, and I'm going to read his letter, and I'm going to say it complies with Colorado law. So to answer your question, Judge, the record is absolutely clear. I don't believe Judge O'Hara ever considered international shoe or minimum contacts because he wasn't asked to.
But the question is whether he was required to. I mean, that's really the guts of this case. Was Judge O'Hara required, once someone uses the term personal jurisdiction, does a judge sitting on that case have to say, well, was there personal jurisdiction? And personal jurisdiction involves more than service. That's what we're struggling with, I think.
But when the appellant's attorney says, no, we don't have an argument on personal jurisdiction, that's not our argument. We are not raising that issue for this hearing. We are not raising it. We don't want you to decide it. We are not putting on any evidence about there are no contacts. There's no evidence in the record about that at all. The only evidence in the record is in the pleadings, which favor us. There's not even any testimony by the husband that there wasn't any contacts. He testified. There wasn't any testimony about it. The only record is, it says right in the petition, which is page, I think it's page 44. It wasn't my fault about how screwed up that record is. What the clerks did, and I don't know if you got it, what the clerks did was they sorted out the file like you do all divorce cases.
I don't think you need to go
into that. Page 76 of the record says that husband lived in the UK. Page 50 says he had significant contacts there. I mean, that's the record. That's what it said. So, Judge Berg, what would you say? Shouldn't the judge have decided that? And the answer is, when somebody says, if they don't raise it, if they say it's not an issue anymore, we've resolved that issue, and over and over and over, opposing counsel says, that's not an issue anymore. Here's all you decide. Then I don't think you have to decide.
But in the post-trial order, the court recognized that husband had raised the issue of personal jurisdiction and that the court had decided the issue of personal jurisdiction. Was it, so regardless of what you said was conceded or not at the hearing, the court acknowledged that it had that issue before and that it decided the issue.
I think the way that was framed, and again, I could be mistaken, I think the way it was framed was he served with process and did he have notice of the hearing?
That's true. It said personal jurisdiction because of lack of process. But regardless, there was a personal jurisdiction question resolved by the court. Maybe it wasn't the one raised on appeal, but I'm having trouble understanding your claim that personal jurisdiction was never resolved by the court because it was never raised to the court.
The judge took up as to whether or not service of the petition and the summons in Colorado was sufficient service. Okay. Mr. Serbinen said, yes, that's proper service. I agree with that. He had raised issues earlier about the Hague Convention, how you're supposed to serve. He agreed with that. Then he later argued that there was no notice of the financial hearing. But he never raised the issue the way you're raising it, which is there's personal service, is there jurisdiction? He never raised the issue that way. The only issue he raised was, is there personal service?
But except for his post-trial motion.
Well, but at that time, it's too late.
Well, but at that point, the trial court said, that's the same issue you raised before that I've rejected.
At that time, and that's fine. That's what he said. But I think all Judge O'Hara is saying is that, look it, we tried the case. The attorney who tried the case said, I agree he's been properly served, and I agree you have jurisdiction to decide whether or not this is child support. That's what he said.
Okay, thank you, Mr. McCullough.
So quickly, just to amplify the points that Judge Navarro was raising, the post-trial order says the court finds that husband's arguments contained in the present motion, referring to the post-trial motion, have been raised in the past tense, argued in the past tense, and addressed prior to the order confirming registration. In the same paragraph, the trial court says, as noted previously, this court found that husband conceded actual service, which is sufficient for the English court to acquire jurisdiction over him. That is a factual finding. That is actually a legal conclusion that this court can review and should review, regardless of the status of the transcript at the hearing. It was raised in a post-trial motion properly as an error of law, and the judge addressed it, and this court can rectify that. With respect to the Malwitz reference, that it's not even analogous. In the Malwitz case, cited by counsel, there was evidence that the father had been terrorizing the mother, so she fled the jurisdiction and actually came here from, I believe it was Texas. In this case, the stated reason for her leaving was because he wasn't having sex with her. A little bit of difference than terrorizing somebody.
Mr. Weinberg, let me ask you the same question I asked Mr. DiCola. If we determine that there isn't a sufficient record for us to determine whether this judgment can be recognized constitutionally by a Colorado court, what do we do?
I'm not going to have time to answer that unless you let me go over.
I'll give you a few seconds to answer the question.
So I think I alluded to this earlier. I think under the one standard, which just simply required a finding of domicile or residence, there isn't any dispute that Mr. Lohman was not domiciled in the U.K.
I don't want you to argue the facts. What do we do? Do we remand it? Do we just vacate the judgment? What do we do?
So again, it depends on how you get there. Under the analysis that I was going down, I think the judgment's just void and the judgment is reversed. If you go to the analysis under an international shoe minimum contacts issue, I think you'd have to reverse the conclusion that service in this context gave the British court jurisdiction and remand it to determine whether or not there were minimum contacts.
Okay. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case is submitted, and this completes our docket, and the court will be in recess.
Thank you.